serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Easter weekend 2018 with a trip back in time to 1945, when Easter Sunday also fell on April 1st. That was the day the bloody Battle of Okinawa began. It was the first taste of combat, and we're about to hear how literal that word taste is in this instance, for an 18-year-old sailor from Southern California named George Christman, who had been assigned to Beach Party Team 62.
Easter Sunday, we climbed out of the cargo ship, lounged cargo nets, loaded ourselves onto them Amtraks because they weren't sure what the beach was when you get into the beach with the ship. So we went on the Amtraks. We gathered out. It was still dark. Gathered around a big circle. We had Easter sunrise service there with the chaplain. And after the chaplain had the Easter sunrise service, we left for the beach. And about that time, my commander, the beach master, had his radio, and all the big ships started shelling the beach where we were going to land to clear it further. And then as soon as we got near the beach, stopped that shelling, and the Amtrak continued on. The Army went ashore. About the third wave, we went ashore, dug our foxholes, set up the radio communications and beach markers, and started unloading ships. Very scary.
I would imagine so, and a pretty important role in that invasion. But you said the first thing you guys did was you had an Easter sunrise service. The right. Chaplain led the way with that. Do you remember anything about what was said there or what that meant to you to start that day that way?
Nope. Just scary.
Yeah. I imagine you felt like you were going to need some extra protection.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And so you talk about the beachmaster and this landing party. So basically your guy's job was to get there first and set up some kind of organization so all these waves and waves and waves of troops coming ashore would be organized and going in the right direction.
Right.
Is that right?
The beachmaster's job is to direct that landing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a pretty dangerous job, too, though.
Well, yes, it is.
Did you guys come under enemy fire?
Yes. We had a lot of Japanese up there in the mountains that were shooting at us.
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
Duck.
You had a foxhole and you'd...
Yeah, but the foxhole was only about a foot deep.
That doesn't do much good.
Because you had hard pan.
Uh-huh.
So you dug whatever you could and you lay down in there, and then it rained and we got full of water and... Didn't worry about the water. Just get down in there.
I'm trying to imagine myself in your shoes here. You're 18 years old. You're in a foxhole on the beach at Okinawa, and Japanese shells are coming in.
Well, the shells weren't coming in. It was just small fire.
Just small arms fire. But you're still feeling a little danger there.
Yes, especially at night.
And there's not a whole lot you can do to protect yourself, is there?
No.
So what goes through your mind when you're in that foxhole and you still hear these rounds going off around you?
Hope you live for the next day. And when we, well, that first day, we looked up there and it was a little house about, 50 yards or 100 yards away. They were flying the Japanese flag.
Mm-hmm.
So about three of us went up there and first we called in for an American flag to be sent in. They sent the flag in. When we got the flag, we went over to took the flagpole down. It's one of those flagpoles where you pull a pin out and the whole pole comes down.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the flag down. We put the American flag up and put the flag back. Pull back up, and that little house that was there, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a guy up on the roof was shooting at people. So eventually, after we had the American flag up, we went up there with a couple of hand grenades and blew up the whole building. And he was down on the ground, dead. No,
but you didn't
shell.
Know he was there when you were taking the flag.
No.
He could have killed you.
Oh, yeah. And then after I took the flag down, I put the flag in my pocket. You got to do jumbo pockets and put it in my pocket. When I got back on the ship 4 days later, I still had this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I put it in my treasure chest, and my daughter was going through my stuff for 4 or 5 years. Well, it's been about 10 years now. And she found this flag. Said, "What's this flag, Dad?" And I told her, I said, "That's the one we took off a flagpole in Okinawa." And so I folded it up and put it away, and I still got the flag now.
And I imagine there were a few American servicemen, whether they were Navy like you or Army or Marines or even Army Air Corps, that ended up on Okinawa, because that was a long, drawn-out battle over a lot of territory. There are probably quite a few of them that ended up bringing a flag of some kind back. But my guess is yours might be the first one. Could anyone have grabbed the flag on Okinawa before you did?
any one of the three that took it down. I cut it off because it was tied onto the pole.
Yes, but so there were three of you, but there was only one flag.
Right.
So you got that flag, and I'm just saying timeline-wise, because this is the first day of the battle, and you're in there early on, you were probably the first American to take a Japanese flag on Okinawa.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Iwo Jima, they had Marines, they had photographers.
Yep.
Okinawa was Army. They didn't have photographers.
So you could have been part of a Joe Rosenthal photo if Rosenthal was there to take it.
Yeah.
What, and we'll talk more about that flag and how it's come back around and led to some other developments in more recent history. But what was the significance of that for you, to cut down this Japanese flag, not just to take it for yourself, but to put up in its place the Stars and Stripes?
That's amazing. A lot of memories go by there. I look back at that flag and salute it and say, oh, there's my flag. Mm-hmm. That's our country.
And there was a long way to go in that battle.
Oh, yes. 10,000 a day were being killed.
And you'd be back on the ship for most of it.
Yeah.
But you did see some. So the first day on Okinawa, you're one of the first in. You take this flag. Still the Japanese are firing on you guys. How long did that day feel? We hear about June 6th of 44 and those guys who hit the beach at Normandy, and they call that the longest day. But how long of a day was April 1, 1945 for you?
Seemed like it never ended.
Yeah?
Especially about dusk. When it got dusk, it was about 50 Japanese planes coming over, those kamikaze pilots. Oh, it just blackened the sky. And here they come, and you just jump in and dive into your foxhole. Here come the Beachmaster down the way, and he tripped over one of the wires from the beach marker.
Uh-huh.
And when he tripped over it, he fell, tipped over. You know, he used to be a football player. So he went over, and his helmet fell off. He gathered up the helmet, put it on his head, dove into his water-filled foxhole. I can still see that big, tall guy diving in that foxhole, holding his helmet on his arm.
Uh-huh.
And these planes, terrible noise. They couldn't get any planes off because it was just about dusk, and they didn't get any planes off. So all the ships at sea were firing.
So you have a pretty good seat for this show.
Yeah.
The ships are close enough to shore that you can see them.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the kamikazes attacking them. Is that a bit of a helpless feeling? Do you find yourself cheering?
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Just pray that you don't get hit.
Yeah, and pray those guys out on the ships are safe.
Because they've got some of those planes were hitting right near the beach, blowing up.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose any friends that day?
No. Luckily, we were on the beach and the Army was moving ahead.
Uh-huh.
We had friends that got shot, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I got hit one time in my hand, but that's a small shell. You know, a small arm, so...
It was that day, or
reach down, yeah. Reach down, pull it out with your teeth, because it burns. It burns like it's on fire.
Okay, you're saying that like it's not a big deal, but the rest of us, for the most part, have not been in these kind of situations. So you're 18 years old, you're on the beach on the first day of one of the biggest battles in the history of the world, and a bullet hits you?
Yep. You're scared.
So you're trying to direct troops who are still coming into shore?
Yeah, and call for whatever supplies they needed.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. It's probably just go, go, go?
It is go, go, go. You don't sleep for 3-4 days.
Literally.
You're up all night long calling the radio. And you might nap, but that's about it.
As troops come ashore, they keep moving inland, but you're staying there to keep things moving and coordinate what's happening. But in that job, you're on the radio, and did you know people were shooting at you, or did you just feel it out of nowhere?
You could hear them.
You could hear guns going off.
Yeah, the Japanese, they'd had the cliff up there. It was mountains, and they had dug in big shelters up on the cliffs, and they had trails. And they'd packed the dead bodies they'd packed in front as a guard.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking over the dead bodies. And we ended up going up there and with hand grenades and sneaking up there and throwing the hand grenade in the cave that they had built so it would be, wouldn't be any more small arm fire.
But before that, you actually get hit in the hand.
Yeah. We didn't worry about that. Well, just a small one.
Well, what did it feel like? How did you realize what had happened?
It just burned like somebody hit you with a hot coals.
And you look down at your hand, and what do you see?
It was right here in the wrist.
Your left wrist.
You just reach in there, and nothing else to grab, and so you bite on it, spit it out, and burn your lips. And you do what you have to.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I'm picturing this. And again, you're talking about this so mundanely, like this is something that just happens. But you have a bullet that lodges in your wrist, a hot piece of metal.
Yeah.
And you took your teeth and bit in and got it out of there.
Yeah.
You'd never done that before.
Nope. We've been trained, though, for first-line medics because there's no doctors on there.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody gets shot or a shrapnel or whatever, you can do a minor incision and take it out. If they break a bone, you feel with it.
Uh-huh.
And you find out what's the matter, and then you tape it up. Most of those guys were, I don't care. I'm going to go on. Get me well, and I'm going. My job is to fight. Give me my rifle.
So you'd been trained to render first aid if people were injured around you. But is that how you were trained to do it, to bite a bullet out of somebody?
No, you just do what you have to.
So when it hits you, you go ahead and you clamp down on the bullet and pull it out of there and spit it out naturally. Didn't think about saving it for your kids?
Nope.
You weren't thinking about ever being married or having kids at that point.
Saving your life. Your life is more important. Get it out of there.
So what did it look like after you took the bullet out of there? I imagine there's some blood, right?
Yeah, there was blood. It was sore. You push it back together as much as you can and put a bandage over it.
Uh-huh. You had to do that all by yourself?
Yeah. Put a little sulfaformaldehyde in it and bandage it up.
Mm-hmm. Did they give you the Purple Heart?
No, because there was nobody there, no medics.
Uh-huh.
So I got in my paperwork. It was signed by the officer that I had a Purple Heart, but I can't get one because it's not in the medical records.
Really? Does that matter to you? Would you like to have the Purple Heart?
No, that's not a big prize.
Well, just the fact that you got hit in the wrist, that's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I think it's pretty close to the old heart, but it's only a small arms, you know, like a .22 bullet.
Well,
so if it hits a bone, it's going to just smush her. It's not going to be like a big .30-30 rifles that the Army was using.
Well, still, if it's in the right spot.
Oh, yeah.
That could be it for you.
The neck, the head.
Yeah. So you said you were scared before that happened.
And you're scared after.
More scared?
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep doing your job.
You do your job.
And you said you guys didn't sleep that whole 4 days you were there?
You'd nap once in a while, but the minute you go to sleep, there's something going on, blowing up someplace.
How did you do that? What do you think happened inside of you to enable you to carry out those duties, to stay awake, to keep fighting, to doing whatever you were doing?
Just the flow of adrenaline.
Yeah.
Just keeps you moving.
I'm imagining you had never experienced anything quite like that before.
Nope. No. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. So what were those ensuing days like?
Oh, they tapered off a little bit when the Army kept further in, and the airplanes quit flying over.
Uh-huh.
So it got better. Got a little easier to take.
Was it more challenging in the dark than it was during the daytime?
No, more challenging in the daytime.
Why?
You had more Amtraks coming ashore. Amtraks coming back with somebody that's been shot, and they all they want to do is get that bullet out or get that shrapnel out or whatever it is, and then go on. They don't even want to give you their name and their number. I'd get their name and number and turn it over to their officer so their officer could make sure that they followed up with the medics, that they didn't get any kind of infection or whatever, and got properly treated like in a hospital station. And then they put on their record that they'd gotten shot, you know.
Right. So you're helping people go in to battle in advance, but you've also got them coming back wounded. You're processing them. You got them coming and going.
Yeah.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Well, there's not that many.
Were you helping with first aid for some of them, too, or
yes.
Only yourself? Okay. So you had to help patch up some other guys.
We had a basic medical training.
Uh-huh.
Where we could do minor incisions and stuff like that. We had a kit there. You had to sharpen your knives and everything. It's not like the knives today are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sharpen them.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you had to do in caring for those wounded soldiers who came back?
Well, the one tank driver had gotten off his tank. And he'd gone ashore, kind of looking around to see where he was going to go. And he stepped on a landmine. It blew his heel. The whole heel just opened up in his shoe. The heel part just opened up. And he'd come back, and he'd got him back on the tank some way. And he came back, and he wanted to see what he could do. So he got off, and we looked at it, and it just peeled off, like your sole on your shoe would just peel off. And I opened it up and took the tongue depressors and scraped it out. Whatever's in there, in the blood and stuff. And then I put butterfly bandages. We had to make our own because they didn't have them. We made them out of tape. Put that all around it. Had to cut his shoe off to start with. and then taped his foot up with an ACE bandage. And he says, I said, why don't you just lay down here and we'll get somebody to take you back to the ship. I'm from a farm up in Oregon. He says, I don't need all that kind of stuff. He says, I just get me back on my tank. So he climbed back on the tank and away he went.
Wow.
And I had his name and his number, and I gave that to his officer, and so they checked it later. Then about, almost been 40 years later, I was up in Oregon, in Yahats, Oregon, where they have a big campground like. My wife's uncle was there, and we went walking to get the mail. And here comes some guy down the road limping, you know, kind of limping, walking away. He's older than I was. He was probably in his 80s, but then come limping around, and he looks at me, and he's about 100 yards away, but he still sees me, and I hear this guy cussing at me. You SOB, you SOB, you're the one SOB. And my uncle says, what's this? Are we going to get involved in something? I said, I don't know who it is. And I got closer, and he says, you're the SOB that fixed my foot. Because I knew that he was up there, because about 5 years before that, they called me from the Long Beach Naval Hospital. They said, I got a guy there in Yahats, Oregon, that's in the campground, and they want to do his operation on his foot and take some shrapnel out or little pebbles or whatever it is. And he says, he won't let anybody touch his foot but you. And I said, well, I'm not qualified. I'm not a doctor. I was just a frontline surgeon. He says, well, then that solves that. And the guy up in Oregon says, nobody's going to touch my foot but George. He had my name. I don't know how he had my name, but they probably told him because I had a name on what I did to his foot.
Right.
And so they called him and told him that I wasn't qualified. And so when I saw him up there, he's cussing me, you're the SOB. And so I had to go up and meet his wife, and she was crying. You saved my husband's foot. He said, if it hadn't been for you, he'd have lost his foot. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we do what we have to. That's not easy.
And that was 40 years after the war, is that what you said? Or maybe longer?
Yeah, at least 40 years after the war.
In all that time, had you ever wondered what happened to him?
Yeah, but then when they called me from the hospital, I knew he was okay.
Until then, you didn't know if he lived or not, probably.
No.
Yeah, because there were a lot of guys that died on Okinawa. How fulfilling was that for you to see him again and understand how much it meant
good.
To him?
It touched my eyes.
I believe it. It's bringing a little water to your eyes right now.
Yep.
Yeah, and probably a few people out there listening. So that's an example. Really, you're kind of a jack of all trades there on this beach in Okinawa.
Well, I've been lucky.
Uh-huh.
Every day was intense.
When you look back, is it hard to believe that you did what you did?
Yeah, hard to believe in my lifetime what I've done. The good Lord blessed me with the abilities to do a lot of things. I've taught school. I come out of the Navy as a certified diver. I dove for Chevron in many of the countries.
Before we wrap up Okinawa, was there anything else that you witnessed or experienced in those 4 days that really stands out to you now?
Just how terrible war is, how much threatening they were to coming to our country, our United States of America.
You also mentioned the Japanese gun that hit you. It left you that little bullet in your wrist that you had to bite out of there, that you guys negated that threat when you threw a hand grenade into the cave that they were shooting from. Did you go with that party to toss that grenade in?
Yeah, we'd sneak up to walk and pull a pin and throw it in that cave. It makes the chills come to your skin. You throw that hand grenade over dead bodies, it's covering the hole. It's scary.
I would say so.
I wouldn't want to do it now. I'm too old.
You mentioned that gentleman whose foot you fixed and the incredible story of reuniting with him all those years later. So you saw guys coming back in that kind of condition. Did you also see dead bodies coming back?
Yeah. They brought them back, stacked them up until they get enough to take them out to sea and dump them.
How hard was that to witness as an 18-year-old?
Terrible.
Is there anything that prepares you for that?
Nope.
How did you deal with it? How did you keep going?
Well, I actually worked for the lifeguards in the summertime. Uh-huh. And you go out and rescue these people that are in riptides and drowning and stuff like that.
Here in Southern California,
yeah,
you did that?
Off Hermosa Beach.
Uh-huh. So coming through in a life or death situation was nothing new for you?
No. You do what you can. Do what you have to.
Uh-huh.
What you're trained or what you aren't trained, what comes naturally, I guess you could say. God's blessings, you know, you do what you can.
Let's talk about this flag. You still have this flag today. I'll put a photo of it at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll put a little video there of Mr. Christmas showing us the flag. There's a pretty neat story with that flag. You showed it to a young lady a few years ago?
I had a neighbor that about 12 years old, the girl.
Uh-huh.
And her father says, do you remember anything about World War II? And I said, yeah, a little bit. She said, well, she's going to write a thing of history class about World War II. So I went through her and showed her and did everything with the landing at Okinawa. And when the war ended, stuff like that, and she wrote it up. And she had a picture of her with this Japanese flag. She got first in a group there in Los Angeles. And she went to San Francisco and got first in the state for her essay. They thought that was so great that they sent her back to Washington. And she got first in there. And they gave her, I think it's 5 or 6 years scholarship for her essay.
All because of you and your flag.
Yep. All because of her writing.
Before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything that you think those of us who were not alive in World War II need to know about you and all those other millions of Americans who were fighting for our freedom and, in reality, saving the world?
We just did what the people are doing now. They're saving our country, keeping us safe and keeping us free. And we thank them all for all the service they're doing.
Amen.
We have many in the service now that's keeping our country free. Thank God.
Amen. What are you most proud of?
Greatest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Being an American. Can't beat that. Be proud of that. Don't try to tear the country down. Try to build it up. Let's all get along. Try to treat one another like we'd like to be treated.
Advice that sounds simple sometimes becomes difficult, but is always worth it. From a man who lived it. That's George Chrisman. Like the other two World War II veterans you heard from today, you can find his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And I don't know about you, but as I enjoy the company of family and friends this Easter, I'm not going to take that privilege for granted. 73 years ago, on April 1st, 1945, it was a bullet-riddled boat on the Rhine River, a barren prisoner of war camp in Germany, or the bloody beaches of Okinawa. And we know so many of our American servicemen and women are in harm's way on this holiday weekend. Why don't you say an extra prayer for them today, and also one of gratitude for all of those who have put their lives on the line for us over all these years. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll remember on this holiday and every day that freedom is not free.